It is quite challenging because of the scope of the cert. Cruise ships cover a lot of area when they transit between port to port.
A massive search for a cruise ship passenger who may have fallen overboard. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 3rd of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, remembering the bond between Lou and Don Young.
Morning, noon, or night, you know, she was always by his side, and he's just going through such an incredible loss that I don't even know how he's coping right now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The Coast Guard is searching for a 45-year-old woman missing from a cruise ship in southeast Alaska. The passenger was last seen just after midnight today when she ordered room service. Her stateroom partner reported her missing this morning. Helicopters, airplanes, and boats are canvassing an 80-mile area between Juneau and Glacier Bay. Coast Guard spokesman Dana Warr says it's a lot of water to cover.
It is quite challenging because of the scope of the search and the magnitude of the water that it encompasses. You know, cruise ship searches are difficult because, you know, she was last seen at midnight and 10 hours later was when she was reported missing. The cruise ships cover a lot of area when they transit between port to port.
Moore says the searchers are methodically tracing the ship's path, following routes designed by a computer program that has a proven track record for locating people. The woman was traveling on the Holland America ship Zandam. After she was reported missing, the crew combed the ship looking for her. Moore says it's unusual for a person to fall off a cruise ship in Alaska waters.
You know, I know typically the cruise ships, they have security cameras on board and they'll review those. I don't know if that has been done yet to see if there's any evidence of the woman actually going overboard.
The Coast Guard will continue searching with its cutters through the night. Warr says the weather is in the searcher's favor. Friday was the last day of state employment for Ed Meggert, a 20-year veteran of spill and disaster response. His career started with the Exxon Valdez oil spill and ended when he quit in frustration over the state's handling of the ice flooding disaster in the villages of Eagle and other Yukon River communities this spring. Since 1995, Meggert has been an on-scene coordinator, or SOSC, a general manager of sorts who oversees all aspects of a disaster response. Meggert says during the spring flooding, he was held up by colleagues who didn't think he had authority to spend money for contractors, and he says he could not get enough help allocated to the response.
So we were left fighting, you know, battles on both fronts. We're trying to address all the flood issues, and we're trying to convince the people who are supposed to be supporting us that, yes, the SOSC could sign contracts, and yes, he could spend the money, et cetera, et cetera. And that had never been a problem before. And also the fact that we didn't really have enough people to be able to safely address the situation. We had to send individuals in when we should have sent teams. And that's just something I couldn't do again.
And Ed, were you able to figure out where the problem came from? What broke down? What happened that you could not get not only appropriate staffing to address the different areas that were flooding, but also the money situation?
Our problem was that we had someone who has been with the response fund for, I don't know, 2 years or so, who didn't understand his role. And instead of trying to solve the problems, he was creating problems by questioning everything that I was doing, second-guessing what I was trying to do.
What else do you think needs to change to make sure that this situation doesn't crop up again?
Well, there's a problem with the structure of DEC. We're organized as pretty much as a stovepipe. And each program is separate. Now, we supposedly can reach over and get other people, but those people are not trained. We can use them for certain things, but not for others. And what I needed was trained personnel in this case. And we do have some of those in state, but they didn't come.
And you said you had two or three people working with you. How many should you have had?
A full complement would have been about 10 people at any one time. We should have been able to shift those out at about two-week intervals.
What do you think would have been different had you had the staff that you needed and the money would have been available when it should have been to you to do your job?
There were some mistakes made. I made some mistakes that I don't think I would have made had I been not busy trying to do things like contracting and making reservations and things like that. This was a unique situation. We've never dealt with ice like this before. And had I had the time to do that, I would have done some things differently. And also, I would not have had to send individuals into some of these areas, you know, by themselves. I would have been able to send teams in there, which was the proper way to do it.
Ed Meggert is a former state on-scene coordinator for DEC. Bob Mattson was Meggert's boss. He says he respects Meggert and thinks he did a great job for the state, but he says Meggert let frustrations build for too long before letting him know.
Yeah, he's right. He should be making plane arrangements. In the end, was he doing more things than he should have been? Sure. He should have been out of the weeds more. And I guess I just didn't hear that from him until much later in the response. I mean, it would have been much easier to have sent more people up there had I known that it was taking more and more and more of his time.
Mattson says a lot was learned from the spring flood and ice disaster, and there will be changes.
All the things that Ed brought up in his terms of his frustration, we have captured in our preliminary lessons learned. We compile a list of things. Okay, what went right? What went wrong? What things can we improve upon? And this one being a little unusual is giving us some more things to improve. And you bet we're going to take this to heart and improve our response next time. We won't be as rocky.
Mattson says the state will be paying the bill for a contractor that Meggert had paid out of his own pocket. The weather is giving firefighters in interior Alaska a bit of a reprieve today. Over the weekend, the Bluff Creek fire advanced rapidly. It grew by 10,000 acres and is now just 3 miles from the town of Circle. Sarah Sarlos says cooler, calmer weather is allowing crews to protect homes and structures near the town.
Today we still have basically an inversion layer, a smoke cap on top of the fire. There's fire activity, but it's not extreme fire activity, so the crews are able to continue to secure lines that have been made and keep doing structure protection along the homes along the Steese Highway.
The Bluff Creek fire has burned more than 21,000 acres. It's the highest priority fire burning in the state right now. Sarlos says firefighters are confident they can defend homes in Circle, but she says the weather is supposed to be warmer and windier in the next few days.
The wind is the wheels on a fire. You know, without the wind, you're not going to get a lot of advancement or movement. But then you also have to have fuel, and there is a lot of black spruce out there, and that's one of the most volatile fuel types that we have up here in the state.
The Bluff Creek fire is part of the Crazy Mountain Complex, a group of four fires burning northeast of Fairbanks. A fifth fire was discovered yesterday, 10 miles south of Circle, but heavy smoke in the area is making it impossible for crews to assess it. The Steese Highway is still open to traffic, but fire managers are asking travelers to avoid it if possible. The fires have created hazardous driving conditions, with a lot of burned trees falling onto the road. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a short film documents the Haida language on Prince of Wales Island.
My interest comes from my family and always knowing that I was Haida and always eating the foods.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF Fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The wife of Alaska Congressman Don Young has died. Lou Young died in her sleep at the couple's home in Great Falls, Virginia, outside of Washington, late Saturday night or early Sunday morning, according to the congressman's office. Spokeswoman Meredith Kenny says the exact cause of death is not yet known. Lou Young was 67 years old and married to Don Young for 46 years. She had suffered from what her husband called a slight stroke back in 2002, but former staffer and friend Curtis Thayer in Anchorage says her death was completely unexpected.
She was flying up to Alaska next week, we were going to get together and have lunch. And she had been ill probably 5-6 years ago, had a mild stroke, and she had been recovering well, and she was kind of back to her old self. And then for something like this, it's just such a surprise.
Thayer says the Youngs were inseparable.
Morning, noon, or night, you know, she was always by his side. And when I did travel with Don by himself, he seemed kind of lost. He always depended on her for so much, and they were a very special team. And he's just going through such an incredible loss that I don't even know how he's coping right now.
Senator Lisa Murkowski paid tribute to Lou Young on the Senate floor this afternoon.
Today, the people of Alaska aren't thinking about Lou's contributions to Don's political career. They're reflecting upon the truly remarkable love between the two of them. And in a statement this morning, Congressman Young really summed it up. He said, "Lou was my everything, and I'm heartbroken."
Former staffer Mike Anderson says the couple's special bond is what he'll remember most.
It is dear. They were like soulmates. They are soulmates. She supported him in his job, both emotionally and practically. They were a team. Alaska benefited because Alaska got 2-for-1 on this deal.
Lou Young was always in her husband's office. She had a desk in the front room and was on staff as a volunteer. Anderson says she would meet with members of Congress to drum up support for her husband and his legislation. He says over the decades, Lou Young became a signature part of the office.
This was a lady that would greet you. She would say hi. You come to the East, when Alaskans come to the East Coast sometimes, you know, it's not Alaska. It's not that personal, that meets you and greets you and say hi to you kind of a thing. And when they showed up at Young's office, there she was to make sure that you didn't leave Alaska. You were walking into a part of Alaska there.
Lou Young was Athabascan and met her husband in the interior village of Fort Yukon, where she was working as a bookkeeper and he was teaching elementary school. The executive director of tribal government in Fort Yukon, Bonnie Thomas, says the Youngs returned to the village every fall for hunting season. Thomas went to college in Washington, D.C. at American University and spent time with Lou Young there.
We'd like to send our sincere condolences to Don and his family. Lou was a really great woman. I had interviewed Don Young also, and he told me that Lou was, you know, his true love and was sweet. He shared his story about how they met, and she's the backbone of the family. She's the one that got him into politics, so she had a powerful part in his life.
The Youngs have 2 daughters and 14 grandchildren. Governor Sean Parnell has ordered flags to be lowered to half staff tomorrow in her honor. Funeral arrangements have not yet been announced. Southeast Alaska's Regional Native Corporation has increased the age spread on its board of directors. Juneau-based Sea Alaska has added a youth advisor to its 13-member governing panel. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Sea Alaska's youngest board member hopes to use the internet to interest new shareholders in corporate business. 22-year-old Megan Gregory was recently chosen to represent her generation on the Regional Native Corporation's board of directors. It's a new position, and Gregory says she has some new ideas.
A lot of students and kids my age who aren't in school utilize Facebook and MySpace and Twitter And what I want to do is I want to develop some profiles that have information about the corporation as well as scholarships, programs that are offered, internships. There's just so many things that they could be doing.
Gregory graduated from Cake High School and attends the University of Alaska Southeast's Juneau campus. She also works for the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, the corporation's cultural arm. She's one of about 3,200 shareholders enrolled since a recent vote to issue stock to eligible descendants born after December 18, 1971. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which established Sea Alaska, limited members to those born on or before that date. Board member Joe Nelson pushed for the advisory position to get input from younger shareholders.
We have a generation basically from ages 18 to 38 who are just now enrolling in the company, and she'll be the only one in that age group serving on the board, and we want to definitely be encouraging getting the younger people excited about the company and getting them involved.
The corporation has about 20,000 shareholders overall. Gregory says many new shareholders are having a hard time understanding what it means to be part of Sea Alaska.
I did some soliciting for the corporation to encourage the youth to vote because they aren't familiar with voting, and a lot of them just weren't very sure as to how they should vote and who to vote for. They weren't familiar with any of the board members. I just think we could do a little more to inform them as to what's going on and, you know, encourage them to take action, especially when it comes to voting.
She'll have a year in the position, at which time another young shareholder will be named from a pool of applicants. Nelson, in his late 30s, says he's looking forward to the role young shareholders will play, and he's quite willing to give up his place as the corporation's youngest elected board member.
I'll be happy when the day will come, and I'm sure it'll come not too far from now, that we'll see one of these people coming in elected by the shareholders as a regular full-fledged board member.
About two dozen shareholders put their names in for the youth advisor position this year. The next round of applications will be taken starting in September. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
Alaska Democrat Senator Mark Begich introduced on the Senate floor today a set of seven bills dealing with the Arctic. He's calling the whole package Inuvikput, after an Inupiaq word that means the place where we live. It was Begich's first time speaking on the Senate floor since he took office 8 months ago, and he used his maiden speech to press for more awareness and action in the Arctic. Begich calls Alaska ground zero for the effects of climate change and listed problems like the release of methane gas from permafrost, warming water temperatures that affect sea life, and coastal erosion.
This undermines the entire coastal villages like Shishmaref and Kivalina. Thawing permafrost is causing roads and foundations of homes to buckle. A recent study of the University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research estimated the impacts of climate change will increase the cost of maintaining or replacing just today's public infrastructure in my state by $6 billion.
Some of the items in Begich's bills are ideas he and Senator Lisa Murkowski have already proposed, like more icebreakers and federal revenue sharing for oil and gas development offshore. Begich is also calling for a coordinated research plan to learn about the Arctic on a host of fronts, from natural resources to oceanography.
My bill calls on the Secretary of Commerce to undertake a comprehensive strategy to coordinate Arctic research, to make recommendations to Congress on a long-term Arctic Ocean research plan, and to provide the resources for this vital mission.
Begich wants to create an ambassador position for the Arctic, which would put the U.S. in line with other northern nations, with diplomats working on Arctic issues. The senator also wants to capitalize on available oil and gas. He says since the melting sea ice is expected to open up more resources, the U.S. should take advantage of it.
This region contains an estimated 30 billion barrels of oil and 220 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. The resources can create thousands of American jobs and help ensure our national energy security. We must get the science right and provide the infrastructure necessary to protect human and animal life and the environment.
As part of that, Begich is calling for the Coast Guard and Commerce Secretary to work on oil spill prevention and response plans. Another one of the bills would fund a study on the mental and behavioral health issues in the Arctic.
It would create an Arctic desk at the National Institute on Health that was called for in federal legislation in 1984, but never was established. Finally, it would institute a health assessment program at the Centers for Disease Control focused on the Arctic.
The final bill would create an Arctic Adaptation Fund to help the state, communities, Alaska Native groups, and the private sector deal with climate change. The Department of Transportation hosted a dust control workshop in Nome last week, educating and training representatives from villages to ready them for an influx of cash and machinery. From KNOM in Nome, John Francis has more.
The amount of unpaved roads in rural Alaska has the DOT worried about air quality levels and the possible health issues associated with dust in the air. Northern Region Engineer Clark Milne said the workshop is a response to the concerns of residents.
We, the DOT, are kind of sponsoring or handling a meeting kind of looking in the Northwest about dust control complications in rural sites. And we have a grant that's targeted towards 8 villages. So we've had those various folks from those villages come in to try to both instruct them some on some of the problems, hear from them, show them some of the equipment, and then look ahead to see if there's things we can do in the future to aid them.
The DOT's desire to assist the villages stems from dust's added risk to people with pre-existing health conditions and the effects it can have on subsistence living.
Well, people that have respiratory problems, whether it's asthma or emphysema or things like that, dust can clog things up and make it more difficult to breathe. So anybody that already has breathing problems, that would be made worse by dust. It also gets on fish and other things that you've got staked out you're trying to dry.
State money is being used to fund the event.
In the previous legislature, we had a grant passed that DOT is coordinating expenditures, $650,000 that legislators identified and legislation was passed that focused on these 8 villages as, I'll say, guinea pigs, at least identified sites where there are dust control problems. And so if we can work to try to find solutions and circumstances and efficiencies in doing dust control on those 8 over time, probably over 2 or 3 years, then that'll mean that we'll find solutions for 100 villages. So we're just starting to dip into it. The largest expense so far of the entire program has actually been to try to arrange this seminar or brainstorming session, kind of to inform our clients, get them thinking, and then if we can come to them with suggestions and them telling us what they want, we'll be able to be in a position to try to solve those same sort of needs with the legislature's help for even larger number of villages.
UAF Civil and Environmental Engineering Professor Dave Barnes demonstrated a device that, if commercialized, would allow villages flexibility when deciding how to handle dusty roads. The device is made to be portable with the ability to be mounted on the back of an ATV, where the driver can then test the amount of dust the ATV kicks up. Depending on the amount detected, villages can then decide when it's economically feasible to lay down dust protectorates. Attendees were then given training Thursday on how to use the new machinery. In Nome, I'm John Francis.
A short film made about the Haida language as it is spoken in Kasan on Prince of Wales Island has won the 2008 Indie Best Documentary Award. It was made by Fred Olson Jr. KRBD's Jay Marble caught up with Olson recently in the Kasan Longhouse.
Surviving Sounds of Haida is a very short film, just 8 minutes long. It's a montage of Kasan elders, mostly sitting in their living rooms, and footage of Kasan's landscapes. It has a very intimate feel to it.
My dad grew up here. His family's from here. His great-grandfather was born in Carta Bay.
That's Fred Olson Jr., the film's maker.
Some people around here referred to him as Chana Joe. He used to have a store here in Kasan. One of my dad's sisters, in fact, she still lives in Ketchikan, my Auntie Inga, she was actually born in Kasan, right here.
Olson was himself born in Ketchikan and spent about 10 summers power trolling with his dad and spent a lot of time in Kasan. His childhood memories are a mixed bag. He liked the food in Kasan, but he got seasick a lot and says he would have rather been playing baseball. Now he lives in Jersey City near the Hudson River.
But when I look back on it now, I've been to almost everywhere in Southeast Alaska, a lot of places that most people wouldn't go to, including Kasan back then when there was no road. And sometimes the only people living here were my great aunt Pauline and her husband Bill Blackstead and Louis Thompson, of course, who still lives here. But there weren't very many people back in the 70s during different times living here. So anyway, my interest comes from my family and always knowing that I was Haida and always eating the foods.
Olson gets very emotional just talking about his film, and he says it was difficult when he was making it, and says it's a good thing he had a tripod for the times he got teary-eyed.
So it's both fascinating and rewarding. And another person who's gone now, Willard Jones, he's a relative. I give him a lot of credit because he did a lot of work with me. He put up with me, you know, going out in the field, and he would do things like pick berries or, you know, pick some cedar bark, and I would videotape him. And so I dedicate the Surviving Sounds of Haida to him and some of my other relatives, like my grandmother, my Auntie Pauline, etc., who are now passed.
I always talked Haida to Mom and Dad and everybody else.
I didn't speak it, but I understood it perfectly because my parents, my grandparents,
some of Olson's movie is in English. That's probably a necessity for a documentary trying to reach a broad audience. But Olson has a desire to make a very different kind of film about Kasan.
What I'd like to do is make a film or movies, films, that are only in Haida, with, you know, only Haida or Haadkil have that as the only spoken language. And that's what I'm working on this summer. I got a pretty good start in March, and I went to the Southeast Alaska Native Language Revitalization Summit, and I reaffirmed some connections I had, and I met some new connections.
Like his film, Surviving Sounds of Haida, Olson says his new film, Haida Lives, will be short, maybe 10 minutes long. Meanwhile, he has entered Surviving Sounds of Haida in another film competition in Stuttgart, Germany. I'm Jay Marble.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, John Francis in Nome, and Jay Marble in Craig. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.